Hey, how you doing, everyone? Welcome to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers Unplugged with Dave Wedge. My co-host Casey Sherman is MIA today, but I'm so excited to bring in a fantastic guest, an old friend of mine, an old colleague, someone that I went to war with literally on the streets of Boston as a journalist at the Boston Herald, my good friend Michelle McPhee. Michelle is an East Boston girl. She worked at the New York Daily News. She was a correspondent for ABC. She was a columnist at the Boston Herald. We covered news together in Boston for many, many years. And now she's a prolific author, screenwriter, TV writer, producer, you name it, podcaster, you name it all. Michelle, how you doing?
Oh my God, I love it. It's like you just introduced yourself because there's, you know, you're a hustler, Dave. You always have great books coming out and great projects on the horizon. And I think, you know, this is the new journalism, really.
Yeah, I agree, Michelle. And it's, you know, you and I, our lives intersect from time to time. And, you know, we go our separate ways and do our own projects. But I think deep down, there's a big mutual respect between us. And we always seem to reconnect at some point and collaborate in some fashion. I hope we can do more of that. I think before we get into your stuff, you're going to really love my next book that comes out in March. It's called Riding with Evil, and it's a true story about an ATF guy from Boston that infiltrated the Pagans down in Long Island, New York. The Pagans.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, the Pagans are the Hells Angels rivals, very violent outlaw motorcycle gang. Guy's name's Ken Croak, and he infiltrated, got patched in, rose up to sergeant at arms. He was the only law enforcement officer to ever infiltrate the Pagans. That was their kind of claim to fame, that they had never been compromised. And he lived with them for 2 years. So it's a fantastic story. You're gonna love it. I'll get you a galley.
Are you kidding me, Wedge? I'll give you a quote. That's a great story. Yeah, that's right up my alley.
Yeah, you're gonna love it.
And the Pagans are prolific on the South Shore.
Yeah, well, New York is crazy, and you know, I don't know how much time you covered a Long Island, but that it was in Rocky Point, out in like it's kind of like it's the rural part of Long Island, which I didn't really know existed, but I went out there extensively for this book and up to the Catskills, which is where they were as well, and it's really kind of like off season, great place to hide out and sell drugs and kill people, sort of territory, you know. So,
that's what they were doing. The H.A. and Lynn, it was a little too high profile.
Yeah, it's you know, they don't have big giant clubhouses and waving flags, but they kind of run the towns. It's a wild, wild story. So you'll love that. But so let's
congratulations. Honestly, that is a fantastic story, which you should immediately write a treatment for. That's the name of the game.
We're in some talks, so we hope to have some good news on that soon, and we get some podcast interest, some TV, some movies. So we'll see. But, you know, let's talk about you. Where are you right now? What's going on?
Well, right now I'm in L.A. I'm trying to transition like you into taking, because look, the only way you can tell the truth now is almost through lies, through scripting.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to hear the truth, right? Like nobody wants to actually know what's happening. But the fictionalized versions of these events are the scripted, not even fictionalized, the dramatic versions like Waco. I mean, you know, you and I pay attention to this stuff, but until that series came out, I didn't know how extensive the FBI corruption was in that case.
Right.
And I didn't realize the numbers of people who died. And it's always was, you know, presented as they set the fire.
Yeah.
And then, 20 years later, you see this television series that is based in fact, and they tell the truth. So for me, it's like to take the stories that you and I have gone to war for, quite literally, for no money, and transition into a business that's a little bit more lucrative and a lot less taxing on your psyche is a natural fit. And it's not easy, but it's a great way to, like, look, you and I are obsessed with the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, guys like that ATF agent, they deserve their stories to be told. They gave up everything.
I agree.
Not even undercover. Then there's the trials. Then there's like trying to avoid people killing you. So it's his whole life he dedicated to this. The story deserves to be told. And there's so many stories like that are not being told because reporters today don't get off their ass.
Well, that's true. And, you know, it's funny. Everyone asks me, like, you know, oh, do you miss the Herald and do you miss journalism? It's like, no, not at all. Like, I'm doing the best work of my life right now. You know, I wouldn't trade a thing for my career. but everything brought me to this point and trained me to be able to do the things that I'm doing now, which is tell these stories. And, you know, I actually just read the final edits and, you know, redlined it and all that stuff of the book that comes out in March. And, you know, I got to say, I was like, wow, this is good. You know what I mean? I always like my work, but I think about how I started the story, like knowing nothing and pulling it all together and doing all the research and getting all the files and all that and all the interviews and everything. And you pull it together and it's like a giant journalism piece, but it's really compelling storytelling. So I'm super excited about it. And you're right. It's very frustrating to see the reporters and the editors not follow through on these things that need, you know, there's so much stuff that needs to be covered these days, and they pull punches because they're afraid. And what they're afraid of, I don't know. You know, another book that we did, and, you know, you've covered it extensively, Casey and I wrote Hunting Whitey, and we kind of tell the end of the Whitey saga, you know, where we get into the details of how he was killed and his life on the run, you know, kind of more detail than really anyone had ever provided before. And I look at that story, and I look at the conclusions that we have in that book, and still no one's doing anything. Like, no one is doing anything. Those two guys, Freddie Gias and Paulie DiColigiero, are still sitting in solitary confinement. No charges. Nothing.
No charges. Isn't that insane? I just wrote a story for LA Magazine. Because remember, he was hiding out here in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And Dave, there's some shenanigans going on. Because, you know, I covered the Whitey trial. I think you covered some of the Whitey trial.
Yep.
And the most staggering thing that came out of that trial is when John Morris took the stand, his dirty FBI handler, and talked about how in 1994, how convenient, right, when Whitey went on the lam, he gets a promotion to go work in the FBI field office, which just happens to be in Wilshire, 1.2 miles away from Whitey's hideout.
The funny thing about that, when Casey and I were writing that book, when we went out to Santa Monica, the police station is less than a mile from the house, and the whole neighborhood is under surveillance. There's cameras in that the whole Palisades Park area is all under police surveillance, and the fact that no law enforcement ever even saw that guy, Whitey, walking around. He walked around the neighborhood. Like, no one ever saw him. Was like, who is he? You know, who is he? Yeah. Who's this guy in this Red Sox hat walking around? Like, and again, the way he ended up at Hazleton is at best fishy, at worst corrupt. My personal opinion on the whole thing is that I think it was a combination of negligence and kind of apathy. I don't think anyone was like, let's put him in Hazleton with these guys so he can be murdered. I think they were like, let's just move him and who cares what happens to him, which to me is corruption, because it's like, he's an 87-year-old man, and like him or not, no tears for Whitey Bulger, but your job is not to put him in harm's way, and you did. You put him in harm's way.
Yeah, but Dave, covering federal prisons for as long as I have, there's no effing way you have three wise guys from New England in the same cell block. It doesn't happen. We pay, the taxpayers pay committees to make sure that doesn't happen, because the danger is they'll take over the cell block,
which,
right?
They join forces.
And the fact that he got, you know, wheeled into General Pop in his wheelchair and there's cameras everywhere, and they gouged his eyes out with a serrated spoon and tried to cut his tongue out. That takes a long time.
Yeah.
And it happened in front of dozens of witnesses. And you tell me that they can't make arrests for the two dudes who very likely did it.
I hear there's a lot of disturbing things about what happened there. And again, no tears for Whitey Bulger, but I'm actually hopeful with the family's lawsuit that they get some answers, because basically the way that we lay it out in the book and my best understanding of what happened is that when the prisoners come in, and they're transferred like that, they have their jacket with them, which is the file, okay?
Right.
And a guy like Whitey Bulger will have a big red X on it, and it'll say informant, basically. It basically tags him. It's CI. But he's identified as a high-risk inmate right there. The lieutenant that was on duty that night, my understanding is, again, this is from many interviews and reviewing all the records, called the warden and said, hey, I got this guy. He's a protected informant. He can't go into the medical unit because they've changed his status. We have to put him somewhere. Where do you want me to put him? And the warden made the call to put him in general population. That's the person that needs to answer for what happened, because he made that call, and it's in the middle of the night, and the guy didn't make it through the night. He never got out of bed. He got murdered in his sleep. And that's, to me, institutional corruption.
But it is interesting that, you know, there's some talk out there that Whitey was... Remember, Stevie Lynch had just written a piece of legislation about the Federal Informant Accountability Act. And Stephen Lynch is from South Boston. And there was some talk that I could never really confirm, but, you know, sources were saying that Whitey was talking to Stevie Lynch about the Top Echelon Informant program. And the origin story of Whitey, as we all remember, is Bob Mueller. Mm. Bob Mueller was in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Yeah. And at that time, Bob Mueller was at the top of this Russia investigation. So if you really want to look at corruption and at the very highest levels, you have to wonder if bad stories came out about Bob Mueller right then, it would have upended the entire Russia investigation, which obviously ended up nowhere anyhow.
Yeah.
But it makes you think. It does make you think.
No,
knowing that what we know about the feds, it does make you think.
Well, yeah, I mean, we do talk about the Bob Mueller connection in our book, and you know, it's there in black and white. You know, no one's going to deny that he was a part of that case. But let's move on to your podcast, Michelle, Mayhem.
It's called Mayhem with Michelle McPhee, but all the cops keep saying Mayhem is Michelle McPhee.
I was going to say, isn't that just hanging out with Michelle McPhee, Mayhem?
I think a lot of people might say that, Dave.
Yeah.
You know all too well. This book. You know, everyone's like, stop making money off the bat. I'm like, making money?
Yeah,
I've
right.
never made a dime. Like, you get a $5,000 advance for the book. You know, people think you're rolling in dough because you have a book come out. And you and I both know the reality of the numbers. And it's 9 years of my life dedicated to this investigation.
Wow.
And it's like screaming into the wind.
Thank you for doing it, Michelle. It's hard work. It's often a thankless job, but it is important. I applaud you. And you've uncovered some incredible stuff. So tell us what the thrust of the podcast is and what's the crux of the issue that you're exploring in this podcast?
Well, I think right away, as soon as those bombs went off,
for our listeners, we're talking about the Boston Marathon 2013. Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his brother Dzhokhar Tsarnaev setting off bombs at the finish line at the Boston Marathon, killing three people, including an 8-year-old boy. That horrible.
Yeah, and maiming, horrible. Yeah. Maiming hundreds of others, 17 amputees. So this was a terrible event on an iconic day in Boston. You know, all of us love the Boston Marathon. We love Patriots Day. It's a very unique Boston holiday. And the fact that you had these guys from Cambridge, Massachusetts, who, you know, decided to detonate these weapons of mass destruction near the finish line, well, right away, there was stuff that was unusual. You know, I was hearing from my police sources that the FBI was interfering with them. They were taking their cell phones, like, you know, they're trying to process a crime scene, they're plugging in their phone, and the FBI would just take it. So there was tension, which is not unusual. You know, you wrote a Whitey book. It's not unusual for the FBI to have tension with the locals, but this seemed a little bit more intense. And then on Tuesday, I started getting a call. I got a call that at the Black Falcon Terminal, where they had set up the rows and rows of viewing stations to look at all the video, there were two guys that were sort of sitting in the back by themselves and obviously comparing photos of suspect black hat, suspect white hat. Now, in the podcast, and this is the first time that anyone said it out loud, Ed Davis, the former police commissioner, came on and said that, yes, there was a meeting about the photos that the FBI denied for years that they knew who these brothers were.
Mm-hmm.
For years, until Thursday, until Richard Delores. You know,
DeLaurier,
I can never say his name.
DeLaurier. Get your French on, McPhee. Come on.
I know. Come on. That's my French. Please.
Bonjour. Comment ça va?
When? Who knew? Multi-talented. That's fantastic. So they have that press conference, but Ed Davis is in the first episode of the podcast, in episode one, saying that he was at a meeting on Tuesday with the U.S. attorney, high-ranking FBI officials, and they said they weren't going to release the photos. And he said, to quote him, I was the skunk at the lawn party. Because he was like, what do you mean? I have to get these photos out to my cops. I have to keep people safe. And they said, absolutely not. And he said, well, who is the person that is, and he wouldn't tell me who the person was. Yeah. I have my own suspicions. But he said, who is the person in DOJ who was telling us not to release these photos? And Carmen Ortiz said, well, why are you asking? Because if somebody gets hurt, I'm going to the press.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I have to applaud Ed Davis for having the balls to just say, hey, this is wrong. Well, Ed Davis's prediction was correct because 2 days later, we had the murder of Sean Collier.
Yeah.
And a lot of cops, a lot of my sources argue that if the FBI had been honest, then that murder of a police officer could have been prevented.
Yeah.
And that's what really set me on my way. And Dave, let's take you and I, reporters. We interview people all the time. If we interviewed somebody, because remember, the Russians, and in the context of the current political climate, the Russians warned us that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was in contact with dangerous radical jihadi, family members of his,
right,
that were hell-bent on committing acts of terror and these Mujahideen that were in his family. So they had intercepted some cell phone communications between Tamerlan and this Canadian kid who had gone into the forest, which is parlance for terrorist training camp.
Yep.
He was talking to Tamerlan. The Russian FSB got Tamerlan's phone number off of his phone, and they warned the FBI and the CIA that this guy is talking to radicals. We think he's going to come to Russia and join the jihad. Now, what does that do? According to the FBI, that sparks an investigation. They go out and interview Tamerlan and his family multiple times, but they didn't find any, their quote is nexus to terrorism. Now, Dave, let's say you and I interviewed someone multiple times. This would be akin to your ATF agent who infiltrated the Pagans, blows up the marathon, and you're out like, hey, shit, that's that guy, right?
Right.
So we're expected to believe that the FBI didn't recognize the guy.
Right.
We're expected to believe like a counterterrorism unit agent who interviewed this family multiple times did not recognize Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Nonsense.
Right, right. So, it's funny. When we wrote Boston Strong, Casey and I, which was used for the movie Patriots Day, and our friend Danny Keeler, you know Danny very well.
Of course.
Danny was very clear with us when we wrote that book. He said, look, and again, we wrote that book in 2013, 2014. So it was very early. It was before the trial. So that book came out very quickly after the bombings. But we have some very prescient information in that book, including what you just talked about, where the Collier family told us that they thought that Sean should be alive because someone should have recognized Tamerlan. He had come through the border. He had been flagged as someone that was a risk. And Danny Keeler confirmed that for us. He said, his picture is in a database. Someone in the federal hierarchy should have seen his, should have known who he was, whether it's, through facial recognition or something. But he was definitely someone that was on the federal radar, and that's a huge, huge security lapse there. So what's the dog's name?
Poor Vincenzo. That is Vincenzo, aka Vinny the Ears.
Vinny the Ears.
Well, do you remember the very famous mobster from New York that used to wander around Greenwich Village in his bathrobe? His name was Vinny the Chin Gigante.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
And Vinny the Chin gave me the best piece of advice I've ever had in my life, which I think of often. And he said, Michelle, you have to remember that you can never pull someone up to your level, but they can always drag you down to theirs. Watch who you associate with.
I like that. I like that.
I do too. So he's named after, instead of Vinny the Chin, he's a Frenchie. So he's Vinny the Ears.
Yeah, that's great. So you got the podcast. You've got, are you still writing for City on a Hill?
I'm not writing for City on a Hill. I was consulting for them and making sure that the Boston is accurate.
Okay. And making sure it's authenticious.
Authenticious, exactly. I think the New York Times called me the Boston credibility consultant.
That's
because
great.
Because you know how we are. The minute somebody mangles a Boston accent or they put a kid from Southie in a pair of Pumas, we're like, no. Right?
It's crazy. It's funny because before I was doing this stuff, I was one of those people that would be like, that's not how it is. That's like, Mystic River or some of the older Boston movies. I'd be like, that would never happen. That's not that neighborhood. And like, but now that I'm doing it, as part of Patriots Day and some other stuff, I'm like, all right, I get why they move stuff around and it's for convenience or for the narrative flow or whatever.
It's for money.
We get so fixated on it in Boston. Like we get really offended. Like if someone went into like a Dunkin' Donuts and ordered something that Dunkin' Donuts doesn't have, would like lose our shit. And like that movie sucks because of that. It's like, so, what I mean? But then on the other side of the coin, I've always said, when Casey and I were working on Patriots Day and we sat down at the table with Mark Wahlberg and Pete Berg, and they listened to us and we talked about some stuff, and I'll tell a quick funny story, but one of the things that was in the original script was they had a tailgate at Fenway. They had zoom in, like helicopter shot, like zooming in on people tailgating at Fenway. And we're like, no. There's no tailgating at Fenway Park. It's a baseball game, first of all, so there's no tailgating anyway, but definitely not at Fenway Park. So things like that. But
it's important because in that original script, I also heard that there was a scene where somebody was running around with an arm.
Yeah, there was. There was a severed arm. And we had to tell them, we're like, look, no one lost an arm. And if we put that in there, they're going to be like, this movie's a piece of shit. And it's that simple. That's how quickly. And the other one that we talked about with Berg a little bit was like, the Boston accent, everyone doesn't have to have one,
Right.
It's like, they can just have a regular accent. It's better to have just a regular accent than a shitty Boston accent, because there's tons of people around here that have no Boston accent, you know? And so that's something that's kind of always rubbed me the wrong way, like forcing that. It's almost like an actor wants to prove they can do it. It's like, you can't. You can't.
You know? You can't teach it.
You can't do it.
In fact, do you remember when Perfect Storm came out, and speaking of Mark Wahlberg, Marky Mark, remember his accent, because he had gone to voice lessons for so long, he couldn't do the accent anymore.
I know.
So every time he talked in Perfect Storm, I was like, oh my God.
Well, that one's a funny one, because that one has probably the worst Boston accents, but I actually kind of love that movie.
I love that movie.
It's fun to watch. Yeah, it's a fun movie to watch. And I love John C. Reilly's great in that movie. You know, I love that. So, but yeah, you know, in Boston here, we're so colloquial and so protective and tribal that we get really offended if someone's like put someone in the wrong neighborhood, or, you know, like, you know, they'll film in one neighborhood and say it's Dorchester, but it's really Quincy, you know, and people freak out. It's like, all right, well, they filmed in Quincy. What's the big deal?
Or it's really like New Rochelle.
Right. So, what else are you working on, Michelle?
So I have the podcast, which is going well, you know, it's building and it's great. And the reason I did the podcast, frankly, was because I needed a clearinghouse for all the evidence. Because it's hard. This story, as you know, because of your book, the story is so convoluted.
That's huge.
And it has all these international tries. And so on every episode, there's nothing I say that I don't back up with paperwork, evidence, trial testimony. So I've been saying since the beginning of the podcast, hey, call bullshit. I welcome you to. And the staggering thing is, no one has. Not the FBI, not the guy who is suspected that I've talked about endlessly, because the government says those brothers didn't build the bombs. So the most important and glaring question in this entire mess is that if they didn't, who did?
Yes,
yeah, so
you
really
mentioned a guy named Dan Morley, right? Is that who you're getting to?
Yeah.
Tell us about Dan Morley.
55 days after the Boston Marathon, Topsfield police get a call from a distraught elderly woman who's sitting out in the bathrobe with her companion, with her boyfriend. And she said, my son just attacked me. He held her down and said, I've done something I have to answer to God for. He forcibly put, like, you know, writing on her face. And she told the detectives that Daniel Morley knew Tamlin's and I. And then the boyfriend pipes up and says, yeah, and on the day of the marathon, he disappeared for 2 days and didn't come back. And the first thing I said to Glenda, his mother's name, is, where's your son? So obviously this kid had a break, some sort of mental breakdown. There's a standoff for hours. And in the middle of the standoff, out of nowhere, the FBI shows up, which prompts a statey to say, who called the thieves? Because they just showed up out of thin air. So now people are really raised up. They finally get Morley out of the house. They had to cancel church because it was the situation on a Sunday morning. They put him in an ambulance, and the parents, his mother gives permission to search the house, and they find an arsenal of bomb-making materials in his room, including a 12-quart pressure cooker hidden in a duffel bag next to a bag of fertilizer, including ball bearings that were the signatures of, you know, we saw them all over Boylston Street in the aftermath of the blast. So he had all of these alarming materials in his house. And they pulled over the ambulance to ask if that pressure cooker was live. And he giggled and said, yeah, it is. Now, luckily for the cops, it turns out it didn't. But there was still a crazy amount of materials that were relevant to the Boston Marathon bombing there. There was also a machete, a rifle, he had guns. And as it turns out, Daniel Morley worked at MIT for a long time at a lab, which was right next to where Sean Collier was killed.
Wow.
And one of the things they found at the scene of Collier's murder were burglary tools. And people were kind of befuddled by that. And one of the pieces of evidence found in Morley's room is a recipe for a bomb accelerant for thermite that was written on the back of an empty 6-quart Fagor pressure cooker box, which was the exact size and brand used at the marathon. So, you know, Morley is a guy that we should be raising an eyebrow on, right?
Yep.
But what happens next? The case gets Nelprost. So the captain, Gary Hayward, who's a guest on the show, and he retires so he can come on and talk about this. He's that upset about how this case went down.
Wow.
You know, like the feds came in, took over his case, took all the evidence, cut him right out, then came back a few months later and was like, yeah, he's fine. We didn't find anything. He's just a nutbag. Morley, and no one can tell me who paid for this, but Morley spends 2 years in Topsfield's psychiatric hospital. And he gets out a week after Jahar Dzhonaev is sentenced to death. Hmm. Do you know what he does now, even though the original charge was that he beat up his elderly mother? What? He drives for the ride.
Oh, my God. The T.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
He's
a free man. Is there an active investigation into his role in the bombings?
Not that I can see.
Okay.
But it's not just the bombings, Dave. Like, on the Mayhem Pod website, which is mayhempod.com, take a look at episode 6. There's a video. Remember when Colonel Alvin that night said that there was a 7-Eleven robbery that was connected to Sean Collier's murder? And then they redacted it, which they never do. So that kind of raised me up. Like, what do you mean? Is it or isn't it? So, of course, I go and get everything I can.
Yep.
And someone gave me the actual video. I suggest everybody watch that video because the person robbing the store has been identified by his own friends and family as Morley.
Wow.
And then if you watch it through, and there's a black part, it goes dark for a few seconds, and then there's a second part. Mm-hmm. There's somebody who walks in behind, as the robbery's happening, there's someone who walks in a hooded sweatshirt with fluorescent lettering that looks a hell of a lot like Jahar.
Wow. Wow.
So you put these two together right before Sean Collier is killed, and you have to ask yourself, look, even in the superseding indictment, the feds put out a superseding indictment against Jahar. Mm-hmm. And in it, they write, on the night of April 18th, Tamerlan and Jahar go to the house at 410 Norfolk. They get the bombs, the pipe bombs, this, that, a hunting knife and a machete. Now, you and I have been to all the scenes. Did you ever hear about a machete?
No, not at all.
What the hell? Yeah. What? Yeah. A machete? Like, what are you talking about? Mm. So, I went through all the photos, which I have, and it's on the website, of what was taken from Wally's house. And guess what? There's a machete. Hmm. So Morley, in I think the most alarming thing about this entire story is he's never denied it, Dave. I put him on the front page of the Newsweek. He's in the book. Now he's in the podcast. If I said Dave Wedge built the marathon bombs or is suspected of building the marathon bombs, or police believe he built the marathon bombs, wouldn't you come out and have a press conference and say, what are you, nuts?
Yeah, I'd do that. I'd have a good lawyer.
Well, there's no such thing. There's nothing happening like that.
Cause wow. The podcast is called Mayhem with Michelle McPhee, and it's at mayhempod.com and available on all platforms where you listen to podcasts. And then, Michelle, last thing, you said you've sold a pilot recently. Tell what's going on.
So Jonathan Tucker, another Bostonian, he's a townie from Charlestown. Tucker and I became friends. He's the star, obviously. He was Frankie in City on a Hill.
Yep.
And we heard about this story about a bunch of deported veterans from the Special Forces who had dumped in this homeless shelter in Tijuana. So we went down there with another friend of ours, Mark Consuelos, Kelly Ripa's husband. Mm-hmm. So it's a great team of people. You know, in this business, you've worked enough in Hollywood now to know you really have to like the people.
Oh yeah,
that you're working with. Because it's 16-hour days, you want to make sure that you're working with people because it's kind of a cutthroat industry.
Right.
So we created a team that is inflappable and hooked up with Graham Rowland, who is the creator of Jack Ryan. So I have a master's class in screenwriting from the best guy out there, Graham Rowland, who's amazing. And him and I wrote a show that activates these, discarded veterans, and they go after the Fast and Furious guns that remain missing to this day.
Well, that's great. And what's the status of that now? Is it in development?
We're writing the pilot, and then we get a pilot to series deal, which means they'll start shooting probably early next year.
That's great, Michelle. So congratulations. Eastie girl done good. We're so excited, for all that you're doing, and you're carrying the torch for Boston out in LA, and I know we'll find something to work on together at some point. Keep doing what you're doing. The podcast is important to get some answers in the marathon bombing case, because we haven't, I look at 9/11. We're still learning stuff about 9/11 20 years later. We're still learning stuff about the Kennedy assassination. We're going to be learning stuff, and I said this the day the Boston Marathon bombings happened, we're going to be learning stuff about the Boston Marathon in 30 years, 50 years, 100 years. The final chapter will almost never be written on any of these stories unless, people like you and I continue to do the work. So keep it up. Thank you.
Well said. Thank you, Dave, because you're doing the same work. We're in war still. We're still in war.
Well, my war is in my head.
That makes two of us, I think.
Yeah. But listen, it's so good to see you, and I hope to see you back in Boston. And thanks. Her name's Michelle McPhee. check out mayhempod.com and pick up our books, Mob Over Miami. Mayhem, is that the name of, that's the name of the book, right? Mayhem with Tamlin.
Yep,
Mayhem. Google her. She's on Amazon. She's all over the place, and she's a Boston girl. Listen, keep it up, and we'll see you soon.
See you soon, Dave. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers is a joint production of Mudhouse Media and Fort Point Media. Produced and edited by Mike Joshua. For more from the Mudhouse Media Podcast Network, visit mudhousemedia.com. And for the latest on their podcasts and all of the writing and film projects of Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, visit fortpointmedia.com.